Thank you very much for the opportunity to address the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. This is an impressive gathering of business owners and executives. And I know you all have weathered an economic winter, a rather long one. And what I'm hoping is that this warm spring we've been having will be a metaphor for our budding economy. I believe, in fact, that this is going to be the case. But as I described, I will describe shortly, I think it may be a while before things get really hot again. Now, as you've heard, I became president of Minneapolis Fed about 6 months ago, and it was right about that time the economy started to pick up. I see you're making the obvious connection, so I don't have to spell it out for you, but all I'm going to say is you're welcome. Yeah. Now, I'm kidding, of course, but my serious intent is I'm going to be talking about the issue of Federal Reserve influence on the economy. The Federal Reserve has been very active in the economy over the past 2.5 years, and now the economy is on the mend. It's time for the Federal Reserve to be thinking about how to go back to resuming its more traditional role, and in the latter part of my speech, I'm going to be spending a long time talking about one particular aspect of that, Federal Reserve balance sheet normalization. First of all, I want to talk about our springtime economy and offer you my forecast. Now, I do have to say that the continued demand for economist forecasts is a little bit puzzling to me, given the track record. Now, on that note, it's been said that economists make predictions about GDP to the 100th decimal point for one reason and one reason only. That's to prove that we have a sense of humor. But I'll be a little more serious. My forecasts are only going to be to the 10th decimal point, not to the 100th. So. Before I go on, I should remind you that the following views are my own and not necessarily those of others in the Federal Reserve. Let me start my outlook with the most troubling information first. Housing starts and sales remain at near historically low levels. And these data are disturbing to many observers. I think that's very understandable. After many past recessions, residential investment has played a significant part in the recovery. Arguing by analogy, some are concerned that we cannot have a sustainable economic recovery unless housing starts to pick up dramatically from the current low levels. I have to say, though, that I'm somewhat skeptical of this reason by analogy, this kind of thinking. The housing sector is definitely important, but residential investment makes up just 2.8% of gross domestic product, GDP, in the U.S. The U.S. economy is a wonderfully diverse one, has many possible sources of growth. We can, and I believe that we will, have significant growth in output without seeing a major turnaround in the housing market. But suppose for a moment we do accept the claim that housing is critical. I'm not sure how, if at all, it would affect my thinking as a monetary policymaker. The only way the Fed can influence the economy is by manipulating interest rates. And this is a little counterintuitive, but it turns out to be true, there's little evidence that interest rates have a big influence on housing starts. So for example, in a 2007 National Bureau of Economic Research paper, UCLA professor Edward Lehmer estimated a relationship between housing starts today, housing starts in the past, and interest rates. I should add that then the Minneapolis Fed Banking Studies Group has used Lehmer's estimates to calculate the impact of a large cut in interest rates, a 100 basis point decline in long-term interest rates. 10-year treasury yields. And they were trying to think about how that's going to impact housing starts a year from now and actually up to 3 years from now. What we found is, what they found is, that housing starts would be 11% higher with the rate cut. Now that sounds like a big number, but this effect would be barely noticeable given the fact that housing starts, we need to actually come close to tripling them to get back to a quote-unquote a normal level. What housing starts are affected by is the general health of the economy, job growth and loss in particular, and a key variable is the stock of housing relative to the demand for housing. And as I see it, the problems in the housing sector right now are largely driven by the second factor. For a number of reasons, our country has built a lot more houses than it now needs or wants. And as a result, my own prediction is that housing starts are going to remain low by historical standards and possibly for several years. Now, what does this large supply of housing relative to demand mean for the general economy? It means that resources formerly dedicated to housing are being shifted formerly building and outfitting homes in particular, are gradually shifting to other uses. This points out another remarkable feature of our economy, its flexibility. Resources in the U.S. economy, financial capital, human capital, move freely from one sector to another. Now, this reallocation process is difficult in many ways. In particular, it takes place only because companies are cutting production, closing their doors, and accordingly are cutting their workforces. These jobs, workers have to find jobs elsewhere, and they, as a result, endure the trauma of being unemployed. Nonetheless, this reallocation process is a necessary one if the economy is to regain its health and start growing again. Now, this reallocation process is at work today in the United States, more slowly than we like, but at work. Housing starts, and you can see this in the data, housing starts have remained at a very low level over the past several months, but the economy has nonetheless begun to grow and to recover. GDP, our main measure of this, began to grow in the third quarter of 2009. And in fact, that growth rate accelerated to a seasonally adjusted annualized rate of 5.6% in the fourth quarter, which is very high. Will this turnaround in GDP continue in the coming months and years? I believe it will. But I'm not as optimistic as some other economists about this. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a condensed version on this because I've recently spoken about my forecast at great length. My own forecast calls for about a 3% growth per year over the next 2 years, as opposed to the consensus view among my colleagues, for example, on the FOMC, which is more around 3.5%. Now, my relative pessimism derives from two sources. One is just based on econometrics. We have a statistical forecasting model, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and is predicting the GDP growth over this period, next 2 years, will be about 2.5% per year. Now, the model is a simple one, but its forecasting track record is good, and so certainly some weight has to be put on it. Now, the second thing is that financial markets have healed in a number of ways from the traumas of 2007 and 2009, but the banking sector faces ongoing problems. Banks with large amounts of commercial real estate exposure face a correspondingly elevated risk of failure. And this threat could well lead to continued declines in bank lending, which would curtail the recovery. Not end it by any means, but curtail it. So this point in my forecast been discussing broad factors that affect GDP growth. But as I mentioned earlier, GDP does not tell the full story of recession. And here what I'm talking about is unemployment. Now, unemployment is currently 9.7%, and it has been higher in the post-World War II period. It reached 10.8% in the fall of 1982. But here's a fact that is very important to keep in mind when thinking about our own reaction to the recent recession. From the 25-year period from January 1984 to January 2009, unemployment never topped 8% in the United States. Some of you in the room are old enough to remember the 1970s, and during that period certainly had very high unemployment. But from the 1984 to 2009, we did not have unemployment above 8%. And it's safe to say that I would say no one born after 1968 has experienced an economic episode of this kind in their working lives. And I think it's also safe to say that those of us in the Federal Reserve are not meeting our full employment mandate when the unemployment rate is at 9.7%. We always talk about the Fed having a dual mandate, one of price stability, and I'll talk a little about that in a few minutes about inflation, and the other one is a full employment mandate. Now, having said all this, there's been some good recent news in labor markets. Unemployment has declined from the high of 10.1% in October 2009 to its current level of 9.7%. I think the most exciting news is what happened in March. In March, non-farm payroll employment in the United States increased by 162,000 jobs. That's the biggest increase in 3 years. Nonetheless, I think we have to say that the outlook for unemployment remains not promising. Unemployment is very slow to recover after recessions, and it's been especially slow to come down after the last two recessions we had, 1990-91 and 2000-2001. I'd be surprised if unemployment were below 9% by the end of 2010 or below 8% by the end of 2011. So let me end this discussion of my outlook on a more positive note, albeit with the usual economist caveat to follow. So the positive news of the economy is inflation has remained under control. From the fourth quarter of 2007 to the fourth quarter of 2009, PCE inflation has averaged slightly less than 1.5% per year. Over that same period, core PCE inflation, which is what we get when we take out food and energy, has averaged around 1.7% per year. So basically, the Federal Reserve is keeping inflation at levels that we view as being consistent with good long-run economic performance. But here's the caveat. Deposit institutions are currently holding over $1 trillion in excess reserves. That's 15 times what they're required to hold given their deposits. Now, these excess reserves create the possibility, the potential for high inflation. And here's how that mechanism would work. Suppose households all believe prices are going to rise. They just expect that to happen. Then they're going to demand more deposits to use for transactions. And the key is that banks can actually now readily accommodate that extra demand because they're holding so many excess reserves. These extra deposits become extra money, chasing the same amount of goods, and now this is back to the old story, that this is going to generate upward pressure on prices. So this is a mechanism, by the way, just because households expect inflation, it becomes actual inflation. Now, why might households expect that? Well, the amount of federal government debt held by the private sector has gone up by over 30% since the beginning of 2008. This debt can only be paid off in two ways: taxes or by the Fed printing money. If the households all begin to expect that the latter will be true, even if it's not true, even if they just all they have to do is expect it, then we will start to see an increase in inflation expectations as well. I want to say, and I have to stress this, that I view this scenario as unlikely. For it to transpire, the country would need a combination of bad monetary policy and poor fiscal management. And I don't foresee this combination as likely to occur. But it's important to remember that good policy is not just a bunch of random events in the economy. It requires good choices. And the policymakers, the Federal Reserve and Congress, need to keep this kind of scenario I described in mind when making their decisions. And I can assure you that those in the Federal Reserve have every intention of keeping our part of the bargain. So let me summarize my economic forecast. I do think that the economy is on the mend and should continue to recover over the next 2 years in terms of both GDP and unemployment, but at slower rates than we would like. The outlook for inflation is basically a promising one as long as the Fed and Congress work together appropriately. As for housing will recover, but that rate of recovery is going to be very slow. It will recover eventually, but it will take a fairly long time, in my view. In the meantime, the general economy will continue the recovery process. So the punchline of all of this is the economy has begun to normalize from the events of the past 3 months. And it seems like a good time for the Federal Reserve to think about how to normalize its policy, its extraordinary interventions. I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about one aspect of this normalization process. The Fed has more than doubled its assets since September of 2008. And this expansion took on two distinct forms. The Fed made new kinds of loans and bought new kinds of securities. Now, at this point, the new loans are mostly gone from the balance sheet, but the new securities are still very much with us. As a result, the Fed's balance sheet looks both larger in scale and different in composition than from it did in normal times back in 2007. So the remainder of my talk, I'm going to discuss what the FOMC is targeting as balance sheet normalization. In quotes, it's my term, not the FOMC. And I'll also offer some thoughts on what the process needed to accomplish this goal. So what I told you is the Fed made new kinds of loans and bought new kinds of securities. Let me tell you about the new kinds of loans first. The Board of Governors and the New York Fed worked together to open a number of short-term lending facilities during 2008 and 2009. Now, they set up these facilities with two goals in mind, two objectives. One, they they're setting the borrowing rates and the collateral requirements on these facilities with two conflicting targets. One, you want the borrowers to use them when financial markets are strained, as they were in late 2008 and early 2009. But you also want borrowers to stop using them when financial markets start to work well. And there is, despite some skepticism among outside observers, and I would include myself in that category, the facilities work exactly as intended. At their onset in late 2008 and early 2009, the new lending facilities were absolutely critical in improving the functioning of financial markets. So let me pick a date, January 28th, 2009. On that date, the Federal Reserve had a balance sheet of roughly $2 trillion. And as we'll see, as I'll tell you in a few minutes, that absolute amount is pretty much the same. But anyways, we had a balance sheet of around $2 trillion. It had $500 billion worth of treasuries and under $10 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. So as you'll see, that's changed. That was we had this very tiny amount of mortgage-backed securities at that point. It held $500 billion worth of central bank liquidity swaps, which are essentially short-term dollar loans to other central banks. And it held about $700 billion worth of loans to banks and issuers of commercial paper through the discount window, through something called the term auction facility, and the commercial paper funding facility. So that's as of January 2009. Now fast forward to January 2010, a year later. The use of these various special lending facilities declined sharply, just endogenously, as we like to say in economics, and just because the financial markets improved, and so people didn't have to come to use these facilities anymore. As a result, the Fed has closed virtually all of them as of February 1st, 2010, and we held the last term auction on March 8th. The facilities work exactly as intended. They provided the necessary support when financial markets were strained, and they vanished when financial markets were not strained. And it's worth noting, too, that we certainly can get into the business of making loans to the private sector enterprises for making money. On the other hand, it's good to know we didn't lose a single penny on any of these loans. So the Fed's balance sheet has normalized in the sense that this new kind of lending has largely disappeared. But as of March 24th, 2010, the Fed still has a balance sheet of over $2 trillion. And it's swollen by its holdings of unusual securities. And now we start to talk about these mortgage-backed securities. In particular, the Fed owns about $1.1 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities. Remember I told you in January 2009 it was less than $10 billion. Now it's $1.1 trillion. It'll grow. This is what we own right now. Through the process of settlement, this will eventually become close to $1.25 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities. And about $170 billion in agency debt. And these mortgage-backed securities are also what are called agency mortgage-backed securities. Now, what does the term agency refer to? It refers to the fact these securities are issued by government-sponsored enterprises that are involved in housing finance, primarily Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac create these mortgage-backed securities by buying mortgages from around the country and bundling them together. The underlying mortgages that the Fed owns, on the mortgage securities that we own, the underlying mortgages are all fixed rate ones, 15 or 30 year, and all the mortgages in particular mortgage-backed securities have the same interest rate. Okay, so there's a lot of talk about toxic assets back in 2008, and these assets sort of have the ring of being toxic. But all of these instruments are guaranteed by the U.S. taxpayer. So the Federal Reserve faces no default or credit risk on these instruments. Now, there's some, no free lunches, we like to say. If many borrowers do default on their mortgages, taxpayers do suffer losses because taxpayers are backing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But that's an issue for Congress and the Treasury. These losses never find their way through to the Federal Reserve. The Fed does face two forms of risk on these securities. The first is securities are long-term, as I said, 15 or 30 years. And so their value responds to changes in long-term interest rates. Second, if interest rates fall, then more people prepay their mortgages as they refinance. This means this amount of prepayment does find its way through to the Fed. And so when you're sitting on these mortgage-backed securities, the coupon payment we get from one of them varies depending on how many people prepay their mortgages. So that means we have an additional source of sensitivity to long-term interest rates built into the holding of mortgage-backed securities than we would just by holding, say, a long-term treasury. Okay, so that's sort of the state of play right now in terms of our balance sheet. What do we want to do about it? Well, the minutes from the January 2010 FOMC meeting say that the participants were unanimous that in the long run, they would like the Federal Reserve to have a much smaller balance sheet. We don't want to have banks holding 15 times the amount of required reserves. There are a number of reasons for this preference of having a smaller balance sheet, but certainly one, I think, is the concern about inflationary risk that I discussed earlier. FOMC participants were also unanimous that in the long run, the Fed should be holding only treasuries. Now, why does the FOMC feel this way? I think there's several reasons, and different participants in the meeting, I'm sure, put different weight on these different reasons. First reason, I think, is the simplest. We want to return to our pre-2007 ways of doing monetary policy. We feel that we did a good job on that. We understand that framework well, although not perfectly, and want to use it again in the future. The second reason has to do with appearances. So we originally bought Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac instruments to accomplish two goals. The first objective was financial. We were trying to improve liquidity conditions in the particular markets for these particular instruments that are very important ones. The second objective was a macroeconomic one. The Fed wanted to lower all long-term interest rates by buying up large amounts of long-term debt issued by the government. Now, in my view, buying these securities was good policy, given market and macroeconomic circumstances in 2008 and 2009. But in the long run, owning these kinds of obligations of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac gives the impression that the Fed is in the business of allocating credit to a particular small sector of the economy, namely the housing sector. We don't want to be in that game. We do not want to be in the game of choosing which sector to support by credit allocation among the many in the economy. Finally, at least some of us have a prejudice against holding long-term securities, no matter who issues them. Holding long-term securities means that we have maturity mismatches between our assets and our liabilities. And these mismatches mean that we have interest rate risk that we don't want to hold. So the bottom line of all this discussion is we want to have a smaller balance sheet and we want to get out of these agency securities. Now, how do we want to go about doing that? Well, we could use a passive approach, an active approach, or both. So what's a passive approach? Well, you just maintain your existing holdings of securities and engage in no further purchases. We stop purchasing as of now at the end of March, and engage in no sales. Over time, some of these securities will mature. As well, people will prepay the mortgages underlying the mortgage-backed securities as they sell their houses and refinance. Together, maturation and prepayment will lead to a reduction in the part of our balance sheet that's in mortgage-backed securities. But there's a problem with the passive approach. It's slow. So many of the mortgage-backed securities bought by the Fed were new issues. So we bought a lot of mortgage-backed securities in 2009 and 2010. A lot of them were 30-year mortgage-backed securities. So if we wait for them to mature, we're going to be waiting to the year 2040. How much we'll actually be holding at that late date depends on how fast people actually prepay their mortgages. Now, prepayment speeds are hard to estimate with any degree of confidence, especially if we're talking many years out, because they're going to depend on rates of refinancing, and those depend on whether interest rates turn out to be high or low. So, that usual caveat in mind, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis Banking Studies Group has done the following illustrative exercise. The New York Fed has every mortgage-backed security owned by the Federal Reserve System listed on its website in an Excel spreadsheet. So you could all do this at home if you want. The Minneapolis Fed's Banking Studies Group obtained data from Bloomberg on the largest quintile of these MBSs by value. So you take all these mortgage-backed securities, take the largest 20% of them by value, and then use those data to estimate the rate of prepayment on those particular securities over the past year. What we found was the rate of prepayment was sufficiently slow that only half of the mortgages will vanish from the balance sheet every decade. So this estimate would imply, as I said, it comes with these usual caveats, but it would imply that as late as 2030, the Fed would still be holding something like $250 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. So So the passive approach is the slow approach. It will leave the Fed Reserve holding significant amounts of mortgage-backed securities for many years to come. If the Fed wants to normalize its balance sheet in the next 5, 10, or even 20 years, it needs to supplement the passive approach with an active one. In plainer English, it will have to sell mortgage-backed securities. So let me talk about sales. I think sales present an unusual challenge for the Fed because it requires to make a particular kind of credible commitment. So to understand this commitment, I think it's useful for me to talk through it in a situation that I view as roughly analogous. Okay, so now at this point, I'm going to take you back in time to I'm sure some of the most pleasant times of your life when you're sitting in Econ 1 class. For those of you who did not see Econ 1 class, this will be an opportunity for you to have that experience, at least for the next 5 minutes. So you know, this is how all these examples in Econ 1 start out. Suppose Sarah owns two houses in the same block. Sarah decides she wants to sell both these houses. How should Sarah accomplish this change? I'm going to talk through this little word problem, essentially, because I think it's very relevant. Now, so Sarah has these two houses in the same block. If she sells both the houses at once, she's going to suffer some serious losses on each of them. They end up competing with one another. They're both in the same block, so they're going to end up competing with one another. What she has to do is sell the houses slowly over time so they don't end up competing with one another. Now, how slowly is going to depend on the particulars of market conditions. In my neighborhood right now, I would estimate she would have to sell one house per year would be about the right speed. But maybe I'm being over optimistic. So suppose Sarah puts one house in the market and tells everyone that she's not going to sell the other one until a year later. Then she sells the first house, she's successful, she sells the first house after a month. It sells at a high price because the buyers don't want to have to wait a year to get a house in this particular block, which is very happens to be a nice one. Now at this stage, what's Sarah supposed to do? She's supposed to wait a year to sell her second house. But she was only planning to wait this long to protect the first house from competition from the second one. Now she's already sold the first house at a high price, she has no reason to wait anymore. She will not fulfill her promise to wait a year. But now think what Sarah's inability to wait means for her first sale. The potential buyers of the first house all realize they won't have to wait a year to get a chance to buy a house in this block. They won't be willing to pay a high price for the first house. Sarah's lack of credibility means the first house will necessarily sell at the same price as if she were actually selling both houses at the same time. People realize that she will not fulfill her commitment to wait a year to sell the second house. The Fed faces exactly the same problems when undertaking to sell mortgage-backed securities. Like Sarah, if we were to try to sell our $1.1 trillion worth of holdings all at once, the sales price for these mortgage securities would be very low. Long-term interest rates would spike up, which the Fed does not want. Now, like Sarah, the Fed can solve this problem by spacing our sales out over time. But again, like Sarah, the Fed faces a commitment problem. The Fed wants to sell gradually, in large part, to ensure that its early sales of mortgage-backed securities are at a high price. But once those early sales are made, the Fed has an increased incentive to sell its mortgage-backed securities more and more rapidly. And as in Sarah's case, if the market believes the Fed will act on this increased incentive, the Fed will only be able to sell its early mortgage-backed securities at a low price. Under this story, any mortgage-backed security sales, no matter how small, could end up having big effects on long-term interest rates. So far, sales sound pretty challenging. Fortunately, the analogy I've just described between Sarah and the Federal Reserve is incomplete. And the difference gets at the very heart of what the Federal Reserve is about. Our structure, and in particular our independence from Congress and the President, means that we're set up to act in the public's long-run interest, not to maximize short-run political or monetary gain. The structure means that with the right set of policymakers in the FOMC, and I'm for some reason even more convinced than usual that we do have that, the Fed can credibly make and keep long-run commitments. And indeed, our credibility has been critical in the past crisis. Since July 2007, the monetary base has more than doubled. Public debt has gone up by more than 30%, as I described to you. At the same time, long-run inflation expectations embedded in the prices of 5-year or 10-year inflation index TIPS bonds, for example, have moved slightly, if at all. The public and markets trust the Fed to keep inflation under control. And we will fulfill their trust. But this same structure means the Fed can credibly commit to selling mortgage-backed securities slowly over time. So along these lines, in testimony before Congress in late March, Chairman Bernanke described how he expected MBS sales to work. He emphasized that the timing of starting sales, like any other move by the FOMC, would depend on his assessment of economic conditions. But once conditions are right, he suggested the Fed could reduce its holdings, its balance sheet, by pre-announcing and then implementing a slow, gradual path of sales. So I've only been a numbers guy, and so I found it helpful in my own thinking to not just talk about the word slow and gradual, but to put some actual numbers on the table. There's lots of possible plans out there, but let me pick one. Suppose we were to commit to the public to sell $15 billion to $25 billion worth per month of mortgage-backed securities. This path of sales, combined with prepayments, would get the Fed out of MBSs within 5 years after they started selling. The plan would also return the Federal Reserve's balance sheet to a normal size so that excess reserves would be normalized at their 2007 levels well before the end of this 5-year period. Just as importantly, I feel confident this slow pace of sales would have little or no impact on MBS prices or long-term interest rates. So let me sum up what I've been describing to you. It is likely that the Fed will have to sell a non-trivial amount of mortgage-backed securities if it is to be able to normalize its balance sheet in the next 2 decades. Such sales might cause untoward jumps in long-term interest rates unless the Fed is able to credibly commit to a sufficiently slow pace of sales. Fortunately, as is true in all realms of monetary policy, the Fed is well situated to make, communicate, and carry out such a commitment. I am optimistic that we will be able to normalize our balance sheet by the end of the teens. So I've covered a lot of ground in this talk, from the housing sector to the general economy to the Fed balance sheet. My overarching theme throughout has been the issue of normalization after the recession. That normalization will, in my view, be slow in the housing sector. But despite the ongoing difficulties there, the recovery process seems underway in the general economy. And it's time for us in the Federal Reserve to begin to think about the process of normalization for our balance sheet and how that process is likely to work. So this concludes my remarks, but I want to close by thanking all of you for this invitation. And some of you have worked in the room, have worked formally with the Fed in the past, with our Federal Reserve Bank in particular, in the past, either as a member of our board of directors or as a member of one of our business advisory councils. Others of you, or representatives from your companies, have shared business insights and help us understand what's going on in the economy. That local representation is part of what makes the Federal Reserve system unique among all central banks in the world. So thanks to all of you who worked with us in the past, and as for the rest of you, we'll be in touch. Now, I would be happy to take your questions. Thanks a lot.